scalar operators. Okay, so this is gonna be a talk essentially about kinematics, how to handle constraints from conformal symmetry, and I think we really made it as simple, almost as simple as possible. At least so far, I think it's the simplest possible method that exists to handle this problem. So basically, I'll follow very closely this paper that we posted recently. So with Miguel Costa, he's here, and David Poland and Slava Richkov. So I won't be giving basically any references. You should look at the paper and read all the references if you need for older work, and there's a lot of it. So let's just start right away. And so just to have an idea of the problem that we want to solve, so suppose you want to study, say, a two-point function of a vector operator, okay? Okay, let's say we're doing, let's start with just a Poincaré invariant theory, and let's work, I'll work in Euclidean space, okay? So I'll work in d-dimensional Euclidean space. Okay, I'll try to write bigger then, sorry. So just with Poincaré invariance, we know that essentially by translation invariance, this can only depend on x12, which is just the difference, x1 minus x2. And then you have two indices, so you can either use the metric, delta EB, or you can use this vector x itself, x12, say, A, and x12, B. And then the only thing you can say, okay, it's here this can be multiplied by a generic function, x12 squared, and here this can multiply by another generic function, let's say, g2 of x12 squared, okay? And Poincaré invariance gives you nothing else. That's it. These functions are generic. But now suppose you have conformal symmetry. Sorry, I should write bigger. Sorry. So let me just remind you. So conformal symmetry are just coordinate transformations. So you go from some x tilde, such that the metric is preserved up to an overall scale. So the metric okay, let me just contract like that. Let me put some function times the metric dx. Okay. And this function is basically it depends on the position. It's a function of x. So it's basically the Jacobian of this transformation, right? So this is a bigger group. So actually, the group is basically composed by translations plus rotations. So this would be what I was calling Poincaré symmetry here. But then there's extra symmetries, which are dilatations. This is simply x goes to lambda x. And there's also another set of symmetries, which are called special conformal transformations. And this one, it's slightly more complicated, but it's easy to remember. It's just you take a point and you consider an inversion, so you just divide by x squared, and then you do a translation. So let's say you translate by a vector v, and then you do another inversion. So you divide everything by the same thing squared. X squared plus And that also is also a conformal transformation. And that's it. So let me say that here I'll work in D bigger or equal to 3. Okay? D equals 2 is a special case. The conformal group is infinite dimensional, but I won't be dealing with that here. Good. So now, if you have that, there's many more constraints here. So in particular, if this operator O, it's a primary field, so a primary field is basically an operator that transforms into itself under conformal transformation. So the transformation rule under this map x goes to x tilde, basically you have an operator, so the operator O tilde at the point x tilde, so so it's basically you just transform all the indices, like if it was a Lorentz transformation. So in the case of a Lorentz transformation, it would be just that. Sorry, B1 up to BL of X. But here there is also a weight, so which is again just given by this Jacobian, and in this notation it comes out like that. So then in this is a primary field of spin L. So I should also say that these indices are totally symmetric and traceless, and this other parameter delta is called the dimension or the conformal dimension of the operator. Okay? So now let me just tell you, then we will see how that comes out from the using a slightly better formalism. In this language is not trivial to impose the extra constraints. You can do it essentially, well, let me just tell you the result. So in this, if you impose conformal symmetry, actually you find that this function G1 is fixed up to a constant to be this one, and the function G2 is completely fixed in terms of the function G1. Okay? So this two-point function in Poincaré invariant theory had two functions which were arbitrary. Now there's just a single number. Okay? So the goal of the talk is to develop a formalism that basically trivializes the constraints from conformal symmetry. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so basically this was just to make the problem very clear. So now let's basically we'll do it in two steps, which is section 2 and section 3 that I just erased. So point 2 uses this so-called embedding formalism. So what's the idea here? The idea is that if you have this conformal field theory in RD, the conformal group generated by these transformations is actually the group SO D plus 1, 1. Okay? So this group, right, is the Lorentz group in D plus 2 dimensional Minkowski space. Okay? So this group acts naturally in D plus two dimensional Minkowski space. Okay? So the idea of this formalism is to say, if we can uplift the conformal field theory from D dimensions to D plus two dimensions, then conformal symmetry in this bigger space will be much simpler to implement, because it's just Lorentz symmetry. Okay? So how can we do that? So I mean, this is a basic idea. It actually goes back to Dirac in the 30s. So the point is that this Lorentz transformations preserve the light cone of this space. Okay, so let me draw the light cone. In D plus two dimensional Minkowski space. And now the point is that we're going to establish a map between light rays through the origin of this embedding space and points X in RD. Okay? So the idea is that if you have a light ray through the origin, for each light ray, you associate a point in Euclidean space. So how do you do that? Basically, you just have to take a section, like a cross-section of this light cone that intersects every light ray once, okay? So that's very easy to do. So to get, I'll use what I call the Poincaré section, which is basically given by the condition, I'll write it, I'll explain. P plus equal 1. So by P plus, I mean a null coordinate in this D plus two-dimensional Minkowski space. So let me write, sorry. Let me use coordinates P, so PA is a point in this embedding space, okay? And I'll write it in light cone coordinates P plus, P minus, and PA. So these are D coordinates, so this you can think as living in RD, and then you have two null coordinates. So if you want in this picture, you can think of this as P plus, and this direction here, P minus. Okay. So now if you take this Poincaré section, P plus equal 1, just go 1 here, and then you have this section of the light cone, which maybe I should use color. So, So moreover, you can parameterize now this section by just writing p as 1, comma x squared, comma xa, where this xa is the original point in Rd. Okay? So this is your point pa, if you want. And moreover, the induced metric on this section of the light cone is the Euclidean metric, is the flat metric. Okay, so if you do dp square, you just get dxa dxa. Sorry, I forgot to tell you something. To show that, you need to know that I'm using coordinates, so p square equals pa pb eta ab, and my normalization is like that. Okay. If you take a constant time slice, you don't get the Euclidean metric. You get the round metric on the sphere. Yes, so in fact, basically in this discussion, when I ever refer to a section, I'll refer to this section. But the results in the language of this embedding space can be projected to any section, and So in this language, you're computing correlation functions in any conformally flat background at the same time. You don't need to choose a background. And then with this construction, now you see conformal Lorentz transformations in this embedding space map light rays into light rays. So through this map, they map points in Rd to points in Rd, and this transformation is a conformal transformation. So Lorentz transformations of this embedding space become conformal transformations of Rd. Good. Just a small comment, because it's useful to compare with later results. In this notation, if you take if you consider the scalar product in this embedding space of two of these vectors parameterized like that, and multiply by -2, you get simply xi minus xj squared. Okay, so I'll give us this name Pij. Okay. Good. So now we're done with points. We already uplifted Rd to this embedding space, so to this cone of d plus two dimensional spacetime, and we know. Now, conformal transformations are simple Lorentz transformations. So now the question is, what about the fields? What happens to the fields under this map? So the statement is the following. If you have a tensor field in embedding space, such that. So, you see, you're going up in space, so in two dimensions. So it's natural that you have to impose constraints to reduce the number of degrees of freedom. Okay, so what you should impose. First thing is homogeneity. in the sense that f of lambda p, so if you scale p, f is just homogeneous of degree minus delta. So this makes sense because you don't want to have more physical information per each light ray. Each light ray only maps to a point. So if you know it at a single point in the light ray, you'll know it all over the light ray. Okay. Another thing is just that the tensor, you want this tensor to be also symmetric and traceless. That's just because you want to map it to a spin L operator. And the last thing is that you want it to be transverse. So by transverse, I mean that if you contract F with the point itself in the light cone, you should get zero. You should impose this constraint. So if you have a field that satisfies this, then its projection to the Poincaré section, so by that I just mean, let me define the projected field with the lowercase. So you simply project all the indices like that. Then this projection of the field into the section transforms as a primary field, okay? Or is a primary field. And in fact, of spin L and dimension delta. So I won't give you a full proof of this statement. I think the more detailed proof that I found is in this paper by last year paper of Weinberg. But this is actually expected because you see, you already have a map. Let me just make a comment. So first comment is that when you project into this Poincaré section, there's some redundancy. So some things project to zero. Right? So it's clear that if you have your tensor field and you shifted by something proportional to the P with some arbitrary function, perhaps symmetrized, okay, to keep the symmetry, you see that anything proportional to P projects to zero here. Because simply because p squared is zero. So when you contract this derivative with p, you get zero. Because p squared is zero, so the derivative is orthogonal to p also. Okay? So this is a redundancy. Or if you want, a gauge invariance. So this, sometimes we call this pure gauge tensors. But the point is that the Lorentz transformations map pure gauge into pure gauge. What I want to say is that this map between little f and capital F is one-to-one up to these pure gauge terms, okay? So given little f, you know f up to shifts proportional to p. And then Lorentz transformations only act, only map this pure gauge into pure gauge. So they go through this map nicely. So essentially this guarantees that conformal transformations are mapping F into itself. So, and that's basically the definition of a primary field. So the question is just if this delta defined like that is really the dimension defined like down here. But, I mean, that you can check in several simple transformations that it's really doing what it should be doing. So how much time do I spend already? How much time do I have? Yes. Sorry? Yes, for this, for integer spin, this kind of bosonic fields, yes. Yeah, so we did not study that, but actually Weinberg studied also spinners. So he also discusses spinners in six dimensions and how that encodes the spinners in four dimensions and the transformation properties, yes. Sorry, I tracelessness. Ah, it's contracted with the dipless two-dimensional metric, this eta eb that I just erased. Right, this by traceless I mean eta eb. Okay, where this is the metric in D plus two Minkowski space. Good. So no, it's symmetric, so it's any pair. Good. So this already simplifies life quite a lot. But still, if you want to work with tensors, you would still be carrying around all these indices, okay? So the next simplification that we want to do is to get rid of all the indices. And to do that, we will use this trick of encoding tensors in polynomials, okay? So we'll introduce some auxiliary polarization vector and just contract with a tensor and then just carry the polynomial. So okay, what maybe. So let's start with the physical field, okay? So suppose you have this traceless and symmetric tensor, you can simply trade it by a polynomial in an extra variable x, z, x was the position, where by this I just mean the full contraction. Like that. And moreover, so this was symmetric, so that's why you can contract with the same polarization tensor, but this was also traceless. So that means that here you can drop terms, proportional to z squared, okay? In other words, set z squared equals zero. Because in the end, you can always recover the same polynomial just by subtracting traces, right? I mean, you can just, sorry, you can recover the polynomial just by taking derivatives. Of the polynomial of z minus traces. Okay? So, and in fact, we will use this work of subtracting traces can actually be solved very neatly by defining a different differential operator. So let me just write. Well, let me write the equation and I explain. Well, there's some normalization. Well, I'll write that at the end. So instead of taking just simple derivatives with respect to z, you act with some different differential operator. And this differential operator, let me define it, dA is... It's a second-order differential operator that automatically implements the tracelessness condition. It's like that, where, sorry, h is equal to d over 2. And the point of using this operator is that by construction, if you consider the contraction, you get zero. So it's automatically traceless, this expression. And it's also symmetric because they commute. And there's another property, which is the fact it's sometimes called interior. So this operator is interior to the cone z square equals zero. So in the sense that if you act with this operator in any function multiplied by z square, you always get something proportional to z square. It never kills z square. Okay? So if you can set z square to zero before differentiating or after, it's equivalent. It's really interior. It doesn't test the function outside z square equals zero. This, I'm just introducing this because this is useful at the end to implement the conservation condition. So, I forget to write here some normalization. I think it's like that. Well, the L factorial is because, well, here I think there's also an L factorial of these permutations. And because of this normalization, you also have some factors. This is not very important. It's just a normalization. Good. So this was just about this basic idea of using polynomials. But now what we really want to do is to use polynomials in the embedding space. Okay. Any questions? So now let's let's do the same in the embedding space. We have our F A1 up to AL of P, and we're going to trade it by a polynomial in, so it's still a function of P, and it's a polynomial of, say, capital Z. Okay, it's slightly bigger than that one, which is just defined as before. Okay? So now let me just draw a small diagram. So now we have many things. You have the embedding space tensor, and then you can project to the light cone, to this Poincaré section of the light cone, and get the physical tensor, say in RD. Then you can also form a polynomial here of x and small z. And here you can also form a polynomial of P and capital Z. Okay? And what I want to do, so this is the usual physical, physical maybe is not the word, I mean, this is a physical, that's the usual language, and I want to work in this language, okay? So before doing that, I just need to give you how to go from here to here directly, and then we can always work here and just come here at the end if we want, okay? So from this definition, it's clear that to go from here to here, what you need to do is just to project this to the Poincaré section. So you need to evaluate. This is a bit too small. You need to evaluate. Actually, I can write it here. You need just to go and take this P to be the P in the Poincaré section. So they say this P of X that I defined is still there. And this Z, what do I need to do? I need to replace this Z by the following, by the projection, which is dPa dXa, and then contract with the small Z over there, right? Small Z, okay? So this I'll call like capital Z sub X, okay? Is the projection of the Z down. Sorry, or of X, maybe like that. And actually, if you work it out explicitly, it's very simple to see that this is just 0, 2, X dot little Z, Z A, okay? So basically, you just have to replace wherever you see, here you have P and Z, you just have to replace P by 1 X squared X A and capital Z by 0, 2, X, Z, Z A, okay? So you go from here to here. And now from here to here, it's given here. It's this equation, star. Okay, so that's the strategy. Strategy is to work here, and only if you want, at the end, you use this formula to go down here, and then star to go to the physical space, okay? So I won't talk more about physical space. Now, from now on, I'll impose all the constraints here because this is the simplest place to impose the constraints. Is all my tensor primary fields are going to be polynomials in this embedding space. Okay. So just one more comment. Under this projection, if you compute Z, this Z of X squared, you just get little Z squared, which we said that we can set to zero, because under the star map, this gives zero. Also, Z of X dot P of X is identically zero, okay? So under this map, all terms proportional to Z squared, P dot Z, and P square, because they are on the cone, vanish, okay? And now we need to translate, the final step is to translate what were the conditions on the tensor, what do they mean in terms of this polynomial, okay? So it's very simple, right? The homogeneity is the same thing. then you have just a simple fact that that the tensor is spin L, so it's a polynomial of degree L in Z. And then you have an extra condition which follows from transversality. So if you shift Z by something proportional to P, you see, by definition, you will get an extra term which is just a contraction of P with F. So this has to be invariant under this shift. So this means that it's a dimension delta. This means it's spin L. And this means it's transverse. So let me recover some of you that I may have lost in this detailed discussion. You can come back now, and you didn't lose much. So the point is really that you just need to know this. A tensor field of spin L and dimension delta is a polynomial that satisfies these three conditions, okay? And you can always set to zero P squared because you are on the light cone, Z squared because your tensor is traceless, and P dot Z because it is transverse, okay? So that's the rule. So now we should try to see this at work. Time. How much time? 5 minutes. Okay, good. Questions? Sorry? This, you mean, this is any beta, I don't know, in R? Or so let's do some examples of this at work. So let's start with two-point function. So suppose I want the two-point function of two of these Z1, P2, Z2. Okay? And let me call this G of PI, ZI. Okay? So now it's just a trivial exercise. So essentially, you can You can actually formulate all those constraints together. Sorry, I'm writing too smaller. So. So this, by construction, the constraints of conformal symmetry are just this equation. Right? Just the same as that. So now it's very easy to see. So what you have a Lorentz invariance, so it can only be a function of scalar products. So you have P1, P2, you have Z1, Z2, and you have, say, Z1, P2, and Z2, P1. And that's it, because recall that points at the same place are zero. So now, actually, the best way to, one way to argue how to show the general form is to introduce the following structure. So let me introduce this combination. So I take this scalar product, I multiply, and I subtract. And, just to keep my conventions, I multiply by -2. So this, by construction, is transverse. If you shift Z1 by P1, it's invariant, and the same for Z2. Okay? So now the general solution for this correlation function can be written as just as a sum of H12. So this has to be a polynomial in Z's. So instead of, I'll first write the most general polynomial in Z1 dot Z2 of degree L. So K goes from 0 to L. And then here I'll have some GK, which is only a function now of the other guys. P1 dot P2, Z1 dot P2, and Z2 dot P1, right? I already used Z1 dot Z2 here, most general thing. And moreover, to have the right degree in L, the right degree in the Z's, this guy, this GK, has to be has to have degree L minus K in both Z1 and Z2. Right? But now you also have to impose transversality. And what does transversality do? It's very simple. I constructed H to be explicitly transverse. So since H is transverse, when you shift Z1 by P, every GK has to be transverse because they do never mix, right? Because this is different powers of H12, which is always there. And when you shift here, you never produce H12, okay? Never produce a term of the form Z1 dot Z2. So every GK has to be transverse by itself. But transversality of GK is too simple because Z1 only appears in one place. So it means that it has to be independent of this argument because when you shift, it doesn't change. And the both for this one. So actually, GK is only a function of P1 dot P2. But you see, how can it be a degree L minus K polynomial in Z if it does not depend on Z? The only way is if the degree is zero. Okay? So all GKs are equal to zero for K smaller than L. This is, sorry, transversality implies this. And then GL and then GL is just a function of P1 dot P2, and then you have to also fix the scaling with P's so that you get this dimension delta. So the solution is just H12 to the L over P1, let's say P1 dot P2 to the delta plus L times some constant. Okay. So you have the two-point function of a spin L operator. It's completely fixed up to a constant. Yeah, I assumed since the beginning, but you find that also, yes, because otherwise you could not fix the scaling of two. Yes. So it's unique. Any questions? Good. So now let's do a more interesting example. Can I cheat a bit? Just a bit, yes. Yes. So if you go through the map and you project to the physical tensor, you get exactly what I was having before for spin one. For higher spin, essentially you get that structure raised to L minus traces. So all the complication of subtracting traces is not visible here. It only appears in this star operation when you act with this special differential operator. So let's do three-point function. And now I'll put different operators. So, okay, again, I'll call this G again. And here, the only thing I have to change is the 2 to a 3. What? Ah, sorry. Good. So let's try to do this quickly. So here, it's very similar. So again, you there's some basic building blocks that you can use to build the most general solution. So one of them we already saw. So it was stupid to erase it. It's this combination. This squared product minus. But now there's another one, which is also automatically transverse, which, let me define it like that. So instead of having a dot product of z's, it only has zi's dotted into p's, so zi dotted into pj, and then you multiply by pi dot pk, and then you subtract what is necessary to make it transverse. Pk, pi, pj. And to get also, it's convenient to have a nice scaling to divide by pj.pk. Okay. So this is some definitions, but the use of that is that they are, both these structures are transverse. And they have the same scaling in z and in p. So now we can try to write the general solution for the three-point function. What I mean is the same scaling in zi and pi. They come together. If it scales with z1, it also scales with p1 in the same way. So here it's convenient to factor out the usual. I have 15 minutes. Jeez. Let me say here it's Q. And so these taus are just the dimension plus the spin. And I did that because I'm running out of time, so I have to do a small trick. I did that so that here the scaling for Q is now also with L. That trick just changes this to L. So Q satisfies almost the same condition, but now the scaling in P and Z comes together. That's why these are good building blocks for that. So the next step is to do, well, I don't know if I have time to give you the complete argument, but essentially what you have to do is to say, then Q, let's do like before. First treat the dot products of Z's with themselves. So you can say H12 to the N12, H13 to the N13, H23 to the N23, and then you can sum, then times let's say Q N I J. And now this function only depends on PIs dot PJs and ZIs dot PJs. Okay? Only depends, it does not depend on ZI dot ZJ because that I factor out. And you can have yes, you can have a sum like that over the NIJs. Okay? No, I mean plus L. Yeah, usually this letter is the twist and it's the minus, but here it's plus that I want. Maybe tau is not a good letter for this. Yeah. So now with a similar argument that we did before, you see if transversality, ages are explicitly transverse, so if you want to require transversality of these coefficients Q, essentially that just means that this, say for example, so first of all, this is of the degree L1 minus N12 minus N13, which I call that M1, in Z1, right? Because this guy already took some degree. And now transversality in Z1, transversality in Z1 implies that Q only depends on Z1 through V1, 2, 3. So, this is, of course, anti-symmetric, right? So there's only one independent. The point is that, in principle, it could depend on Z1, P2, and Z1, P3, but transversality makes it that it only depends on this combination. So now the two things, the fact that it has to have this degree in Z1, and it can only depend via this, it means that this Q is actually just a product. V1, 2, 3 to the power M1, V2, let's say, 3, 1 to the power M2, and V3, 1, 2 to the power M3. Times, of course, an indeterminate constant, let's say some C of NIJs. So you see, the most general solution is a finite number of solutions. It's just all possible triples of N12, N13, N23, such that they do not give rise to negative M's, right? So, N12 plus N13 has to be less or equal than L1, and similarly for the other ones. So this is just a simple counting problem. Actually, you can write the number of solutions, so the number of independent tensor structures in closed form as a function of L1, L2, and L3. How much time do I have now? Okay, so I really want to, I need to move to the final thing because that's what's asked in the exercise. So, any questions about this? Yes. In four dimensions, these are all independent. In three dimensions, this is overcounting because some of these structures that we think are independent are not all independent. Basically because here we are assuming that we have three Z's and three P's, so six vectors, and we are assuming that they are all independent. But if they only live in five dimensions, that they cannot be all independent. So there's a reduction, yeah. But that can also be taken into account. There's some identity that you can derive. Actually, I think that's also in the exercise. Okay, so I should jump to the last point, which is conservation. and just very quickly tell you how to. So this. Okay. No, here, I mean, now the only thing that I could tell more here is we could do. You want to do an example? No, an example is really trivial. It's just, I mean, you just go here and you put numbers. I mean, just choose three numbers here such that they are less than the spin. Ah, sorry, no. One thing I wanted to do, and maybe that will help, is a way to visualize this. So you have to choose these three numbers like that. So essentially what you should do, there's some diagrams that at least help me think about this. So suppose you draw the operators, 1, 2, 3, and you say, okay, here you put as many dots as the spin of the operator, okay? So L1 dots, and here L2 dots, and here L3 dots. And now this problem is basically choosing how many. So HIJs connect, right? So H12 connects between these. So you have N12 links between these two. And then you have N23 links between these two. And N13 links between these two. So the dots that are not linked just get one of these Vs, the structures that only contain one Z at that point. And the links get one H. So the number of structures is just how many ways of drawing lines you can put here. So for any given, if you have like spin 2, so maybe that's what you want, no? To know, to understand the structure. Okay. Yeah, okay. So suppose you're doing spin 2. So then you have. You just have two points per each ball. So what you can do is first is do not put any connection. Then, so but this is gonna, okay. Then you already know how many. Then you can do that, right? Then you can do two connections or two connections like that, right? And the last thing that you can do is that. So of course here you have plus permutations. So let me put, these are different structures. Right? Plus permutations, also here plus permutations, also here. So now it depends if the operators are different. It counts as different structures. If they are all the same, you want the permutation symmetric combination. So if, for example, is the stress energy tensor, which is always the same operator, you want, there's five possible structures. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because of the symmetry. And so that's actually the exercise, is to start from these five possible structures and then impose the extra condition of conservation and show that actually there are not five independent, but there are only three independent. So conservation brings you down from five to three conditions. So you, okay, I guess I don't have time then to explain conservation proper. Thank you very much.
So I've got the two questions. One, if you started with Lorentzian signature, would everything just go through similarly?
Yes. Yes. I mean, the way I see it basically is you can, it's just at the end you have to put some I epsilons in the right place. Yeah, there's no, There's no way, nothing more complicated than that.
But it wouldn't be Minkowski anymore, right? The embedded
space. Yeah. So this P12, when you go down to the physical space, this P12 becomes X12 square, right? So maybe you have to put X12 square plus I epsilon, and that's basically it. Then X12, you think of it as a square with the Minkowski metric.
And the second question, can you say with this formalism something about the non-local operators?
Non-local operators? No, I haven't thought about that. You mean if in the embedding it's also useful? For,
yeah.
It's a good question. I don't know. Wilson loops.
The usual question, if you go to four dimensions, things are much easier. Moreover, you can also, in four dimensions, mm-hmm. you can also take also a supersymmetry, for example.
Supersymmetry.
Superconformal symmetry, yeah. I don't know if you have any remark on this further simplifications.
So, I mean, it will give further constraints, but we did not study that case. No, we did not. But, yeah, essentially, we didn't study spinners at all. So, but as I said, that's actually possible in this. Weinberg did that, so it's a question of generalizing. I mean, there's other generalizations here. It's just spin-L tensor, so it's just complete, totally symmetric and traceless representations of SOD. In four dimensions, that's not enough. You have more general tensors, right? You have some with some anti-symmetric indices. So you have to do a different trick than this. This would be enough for three-dimensional CFTs, right? But not for higher-dimensional ones. There's more general representations.
There is a spinor version of polynomial. Polynomial, get rid of indices by contracting with spinors. Just the usual, like lambda 2.
Yeah. In three dimensions, for example, I've seen that in this recent paper by Sheehan and Giambi and Simone.
Also in four, right? Yeah.
We should talk about that, yeah.